what happens to migrant children once they reach the U.S. border has been a much discussed topic over the past month. There have been reports that the government has lost track of about 1,500 immigrant children. Then there was the announcement that the Trump administration has instituted a policy of separating children from their parents at the border. To sort through some of the immigration law surrounding migrant children, we reached out to Laura Ferner, a partner at Crouch, Harwell, Fryer, and Ferner. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda visited the Springdale-based law firm last week, where Laura explained what happens to unaccompanied minors who show up to the U.S. border depends on what country they're from.
In 2008, there was a law that passed. It's called the Unaccompanied Minors in the Trafficking Victim Protection Act of 2008. It's a TVPRA, and that passed in 2008, stating that children that come from basically anywhere south of the border except for Mexico, that these children are deemed to be asylum applicants and that they have the right to apply for asylum, and that custody of these children be transferred to the Office of Refugee Resettlement and HSA. HSI, which I guess is like our version of the federal version of like Child and Welfare Services. And these children are then to be placed with family members or close family members or close family friends, or like in the best possible scenario. And then usually that happens. So a few years ago, I guess in 2013, I started representing the first kids in 2008, 2009. And then there was a big influx, I want to say maybe in 2012 or 13, when there was like, I think one year we had like over 40,000 children come. And I saw a big influx of unaccompanied minors coming to me. And a lot of times these children then were referred to social services, like private social services, like Lutheran social services. And I had a social worker contact me a lot. And other nonprofits contacted me a lot. So I did a lot of those cases for pro bono for a while.
So once the kids got sent to you, then what happens? Because they're still part of a legal process. The first part of putting them with their family is just the first part of that process.
Yes. So the majority of these kids were teens. So a lot of times they were first placed into group homes all over the country. And at that point, then it was ascertained where the closest family member was. A lot of times these children did have at least one parent in the United States, sometimes two. And so if parents could be found, they were placed in custody with the parents. And that's how these kids ended up in Arkansas, a lot of them. And from there, they still had immigration court proceedings. So at that point, then it was decided if they've had lawyers like me or other nonprofits, I guess, then, you decided what was the best legal strategy at that point to do.
And so with some of the kids that you've had, I guess they're applying for asylum, and then that's a whole judicial process that you kind of take them through.
Yes. So if a child is designated as an unaccompanied minor, they get to apply for asylum with the Immigration Services, the asylum office, instead of the court. And the benefit to that is that it feels less threatening and less intimidating, because you file the application with an office and then you go to an interview with an officer, and it's just the officer and you and I guess your lawyer. And they just kind of, it's like a conversation like you and I are having, and they're just asking questions about why you left your country, what are you afraid of, and making those determinations.
Have a lot of your clients been able to get asylum?
It's hard for me to get a number. So when somebody comes to me, I do a screening process to see if you qualify for asylum, because if you do not and you file what is in the law we call a frivolous application for asylum, you can actually get in legal trouble. This means that if you file an application with false information, not a weak claim, just because you lose your asylum claim to case doesn't mean it's a frivolous application. It just means it didn't meet the criteria of asylum. But it's somebody who would make up stuff or lie about stuff. And at that point, then you decide how strong the case is, and you try to see if there's other avenues to stay here in this country or not.
Yeah. So there's other avenues other than asylum for some of these people?
For some children, there is a process called the Special Juvenile Immigrant Visa, and that is for children who have been abused or neglected or abandoned by at least one parent. And that reunification, and that has a predicate to it that there is a state court or a juvenile court that has decided that it is not in the best interest of that child to return to their home country, or that they that reunification with their parents or both one or both parents is not a viable option.
Okay, so that's an option. Say I apply for asylum and I get asylum. What's the next step?
Okay, so if you apply for asylum and you're granted asylum, then you're considered an asylee. And after 1 year of being an asylee, you can apply for residency, legal permanent residency, or adjustment of status is the correct term.
And then from there, like other permanent residents, you can go on to possibly apply for citizenship after a certain amount of time and qualifications and that whole long process.
That's correct. So after 5 years, and if you're over the age of 18, you can apply for citizenship.
Okay, so there are options. In the immigration world, how often does it happen that someone gets asylum? Is that something that happens often, or?
Well, it's pretty hard, and it's especially hard for a lot of these kids who, you know, they don't have the monetary funds to hire attorneys, and now legal funding for a lot of these organizations that provided legal representation for these children has been cut. So a lot of these organizations have no money at all to represent children, which is extremely hard. So I'm going to try to explain to you the qualifications for asylum. So then you see how hard it is to actually get asylum, and then especially if you're pro se, meaning you don't have legal representation. So the law of asylum is ever evolving, and it dates back to, like, you know, human rights conventions and things like that. But in the United States, if you apply for asylum, you have to show that you have suffered past persecution or you have a well-founded fear of future persecution on account of one of the five enumerated grounds. And these are your race, your political opinion, your religion, your ethnicity, or your membership in a particular social group, okay? Well, now, most of these children that come from Central America, they would fall under the particular social group realm because, you know, most of these children are Catholic or Christian, and those kids are not being persecuted. You're not being persecuted usually for that in El Salvador or Guatemala or Honduras. So it comes down to the definition of a particular social group. And I have to look it up every single time, I argue, because it changes all the time. And it's also very complicated. So this particular social group has to be particularly defined, meaning there has to be limits to the bounds. It has to be socially distinct, meaning that it is recognized as a group in the society. Doesn't have to, it used to be that it had to be socially visible, that people, you had to be recognized as that, such. And and that it is comprised of members that have a trade that should not, that they cannot or they should not be required to change. So like gender, for example, has been held to be a social group. Now, as I said, this definition changes constantly, and it's hard for us lawyers to keep track of it. I can't imagine what it would be like for a pro se client to go before the immigration court or the asylum office and articulate this, his or hers membership in a particular social group. And the last part of that is that the government cannot or doesn't want to stop the actor from persecuting you. So you have to meet all of those in order to qualify for asylum. So it's an extremely hard thing to do.
And I imagine a lot of people who come here seeking asylum don't know all that. They just know that they hear the word asylum or think that there's a safe place, and so they give it a go.
Correct. I mean, there's just no way. A lot of people don't know, you know. They just, I mean, a lot of these people come here because they have a real fear, right? And especially kids. they are afraid. A lot of them don't have parents that live in the that live in their countries. A lot of these parents live in the United States and have for a long time, and so they are not protected by anybody. They're the most vulnerable population in those countries, and a lot of times they had aging grandparents that have passed away or other reasons. You know, there's many reasons why some of these kids come: gang violence, gang recruitment efforts, domestic violence victims. I mean, anything that you can think of has happened to some of these kids. And then a lot of them, unfortunately and sadly, get extorted and exploited on the way down or up, I guess.
Right, coming north from South America and Central America. One of the reasons these unaccompanied minors have been in the news lately is because an official with the Department of Health and Human Services reported that the government has lost track of, or some wording like that, lost track of about 1,500 kids that they're missing. And there's been a lot of reports on that, and then some reports after that to kind of explain what they mean by missing. Because I think when you hear a child is missing, you think, you know, they were snatched and taken somewhere, or maybe ran away, even when we say missing. But as far as the, I guess, legal definition, it's not quite that in this situation.
Correct. I think the term missing is a little misleading. I mean, it's so, like I said, these children are then often released. Once they come here, they are released to their parents or other family members or other close family friends or something of that nature. And within the recent year, last year, the government started to, upon check-ins with the Office of Refugee Resettlement and other places, or when they went to court, some of the parents started getting arrested. So at this point, then, these children are a little scared to show up to court. In addition to, these are children, these are teenagers, and I don't know, I'm sure most people can sympathize with this, but, you know, sometimes my daughter, who is a teen, doesn't answer her phone. Okay, I mean, sometimes I can't get a hold of her for a full day, you know, when I'm at work and she's off school or whatever. So I think that's also something. Just because somebody doesn't answer their phone doesn't mean they're lost. Or when people have changed their phone numbers, a lot of my clients change their phone numbers and don't advise me of it, even though I tell them, I need you to tell me, and they don't advise me. And then sometimes I don't hear from them for like a year until like they're like, oh, yeah, I need to go check on my case. And then I've been trying to get a hold of them and I can't. So there are many variables as to why these children are not in contact.
So it's as simple as they were calling to check in on these people. Maybe they didn't answer the phone, or maybe they didn't return the phone call, or maybe the number has changed. And so it's just they're not entirely sure where they are. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're lost in the traditional sense.
That's correct. They're not lost in the traditional sense. And also there's been reports about some of these children being released to human traffickers. And I find that report to be highly misleading, because a lot of parents recently have been labeled human traffickers because they brought their children here or funded the coyotes who brought the children here. And to me, that is then to say that these children are being released to human traffickers, and there's all this rampant abuse of children going on, is completely misleading. While I'm not going to say that there's no abuse, because there always is, but there's also in our foster care system in the state, there's some abuse, but that doesn't mean that all foster parents are abusive either. You know, it's kind of the same thing.
So by labeling a parent human trafficking, is this a legal definition, or is this just sort of one person's opinion that they're saying, oh, well, I'm calling them a human trafficker because they're taking this child from across the border?
There's actually been reports of parents being arrested at these check-ins and then being charged with the crime of human trafficking. And so that then prevents this parent in the future of becoming a permanent resident because they have that charge against them.
But not in all cases, but there have been some.
Yes, I personally haven't had any, so I can't say that. But I do know of other attorneys that have had clients where this has happened.
And speaking of other attorneys, I have read some information from other attorneys across the country about what's happening right now in the news, that we have this issue over here of people thinking that the children are missing. But at the same time, we also have Attorney General Jeff Sessions saying that the administration is instituting a policy of separating parents and children at the border. And those are two separate things.
Those are completely two separate things. And this is a new policy that they have decided to do because they are charging these parents that are coming in with the crime of illegally entering the country or the crime of human trafficking. And because then those parents are being charged with criminal activity, they are then transported to a real prison. And at that point, I mean, real prison in quotation marks, because immigration detention centers are, for all intents and purposes, real prisons, and they look like real prisons, and they're run like real prisons. But so then those children are being separated from their family members.
That was immigration lawyer Laura Ferner speaking with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda. Laura is a partner at Crouch, Harwell, Fryer, and Ferner, a law firm in Springdale.